It has been quite a month this week. As the flames began to rise over the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris Monday, the online conspiracy theorists were already cranking up their bits of angst and hysteria, as usual. Back at home, the long-awaited release of the Mueller report Thursday, if nothing else, revealed that we indeed still live in two Americas with very different perceptions of right and wrong. In Columbine, Colorado, as the 20th anniversary of that horrific school shooting approached, the travels of a young Florida woman with an infatuation with the shooting provoked a lockout at Columbine High School before the crisis ended with the young woman's own apparent suicide. And this Easter morning in Sri Lanka, the drumbeat of terror continued, this time striking Christian churches and tourist hotels with hundreds of casualties. The end result of all those incidents was an all too familiar grief, and yet a grief strong enough to send seismic shudders around the world. Unnecessary and untimely death, insidious disease, natural disasters, terrorist aggression, government tyranny, they always send shockwaves of grief and fear and despair through those who hear the news. A certain disorientation sets in, and like the psalmist, people cry out, "How long, O Lord?" Not unlike the world the Irish poet William Butler Yeats described in 1919 after World War I. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I find Yeats' words eerily descriptive of our own day. I also wonder if they might not give expression in some ways to the inner thoughts of Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the others as they made their way to the tomb in the deep dawn of that first Sunday morning to anoint the body of the one on whom they had pinned their hopes. The ceremony of innocence had been drowned indeed. Their Lord had been crucified, dead, buried. Then, as if that weren't enough, now the body was missing too. They couldn't even do the one final act they had to offer. The angel at the tomb spoke good news to them, but they were not able initially to hear it. In their despair, says Luke, they were thoroughly perplexed, unnerved, disoriented. The angel spoke, but the women weren't comforted. Luke said they were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground. But then the angels offered them a gentle word of reminder. "Remember how he spoke to you while he was still in Galilee," they said. "He said the Son of Man must be handed over into the hands of people who are sinners, be crucified, and on the third day rise." Then, said Luke, they remembered his words. So they got up and ran to tell the 11 disciples. And did the disciples jump up and down with enthusiasm at the report? No, not exactly. They treated the reports as nonsense. They could hardly have been more condescending. Bill Meehl, who used to teach at Yale Divinity School, told the story of how for a season he took his children to a Unitarian Sunday school in New Haven. One Easter Sunday, his son came home from his class and, in response to a question about how things had gone, said, "Well, Martha Coolidge said Jesus rose from the dead and Bobby Hooker slapped her in the face." Disciples didn't get violent, I suppose, at the women's report, so far as we know, but they did react with the same disbelief. They dismissed their story as an idle tale. Why? Was it because the women were women and men considered their witness unreliable? Sure, that's possible. Some biblical scholars read the text that way. Fred Craddock may also be right when he suggests that no witness bringing back such news to that dejected group could have expected a more significant reception than the women got. Now, clearly, these women, disciples in Luke, play an absolutely crucial and pivotal role in conducting the electricity of that first Easter. So why don't their counterparts believe? Their news seems too good to be true. Maybe it was because if it is true, then all bets are off, and a whole new set of responsibilities confronts them. Death they knew how to handle, disappointment too, but this was something none of them had ever encountered before. This news seemed just overwhelming. We could spend a lot of time trying to analyze the reticence of the disciples to believe, and in so doing would miss our own reluctance. It's hard for us to believe, not just for them. Also, too much analysis of the disciples' reluctance might lead us to forget that eventually they did come to believe the good news. They did become the apostles whose brave acts of faithfulness formed the church. How did that happen? When did they find their burst of energy? Did it grow out of an accumulation of witnesses? First the women, and then Peter, and then the two who encountered Jesus on his way to Emmaus? Did it happen only when Jesus himself stood among them later that evening? Likely some of all of that. But I also suspect that what happened first to the women happened to the men as well. I believe it only began to come together for them when they finally remembered. Remember, said the angelic figures to the women at the empty tomb. Remember what he told you. And as they remembered, only as they remembered, did it begin to make sense to them. One biblical scholar notes that it often happens that way. Faith does not usually move from promise to fulfillment, but from fulfillment to promise. Remembering is often the power, activating the power of recognition. In remembering, the women begin to make sense of the empty tomb. As they remember Jesus talking to them about his suffering, death, and resurrection, the fog around the events that morning began to clear. And it would do the same for the 11. And such remembrance would fuel the energies of Christ's nascent church. And as it has done for the church for centuries, remembering the promises of Christ can do the same for us. For such remembering is an act that claims space and time in us. It allows change to build and grow within us. And we look back on our own lives and remember gospel teachings. We begin to understand the power of Christ's resurrection at work in our own lives. As we look back on those lives, we will also remember times when God was obviously moving, stirring us, though we could not grasp it or see it at the time. The American ethicist Paul Lehman used to say, "Christians are people who hope backwards and remember forwards." Our hope for the future is based on promises and lessons from the past, not a blind optimism that ignores history and just faces the future with great hope. Hope backwards and remember forwards. It's the reverse of what we normally think, but I believe Lehman was right. The hope by which Christians live has to do with our shared past. The empty tomb of Easter means that all the other promises that Jesus made can also be kept. The meek will inherit the earth. Those who weep now will laugh. Those who hunger now will be satisfied. The way to be a neighbor is the way of a good Samaritan. God's grace is like that of a mother who cannot forget her nursing child, like that of a father who runs to welcome the prodigal home. If the good news of Easter is true, And Jesus' other promises are trustworthy as well. And if our hope is rooted in those promises in the past, then our remembering propels us forward to live as agents of grace and promise, not just to believe the promises, but to do our part to help enact them, to embrace the meek, to feed the hungry, to be the kinds of neighbors Jesus described, to strive for the confluence of mercy and justice in this world. In finding our memories, you see, we find also our mission. The exhortation of the Easter angels to remember is among Luke's most distinctive contributions to our understanding of resurrection. In each of the Gospels, Jesus predicts his passion and his ultimate vindication, but only Luke draws our attention to the precise fulfillment of those predictions in the very midst of the resurrection story. The messengers evoke in the women what is, for Luke, one of the most redemptive of all human activities, and that is remembrance. Rather than telling the women to go and tell the disciples that Jesus had gone before them to Galilee, which looks forward, as the other Gospels do, Luke turns the women backward to their own memory. And they do remember, for they are authentic witnesses, veterans of the ministry in Galilee. They do remember, and their remembering prompts them to go and share with the others their awakened memory. Luke teaches us that one of the most important responsibilities of any faith community is the faithful exercise of its memory. Says Rick Spalding, Luke all but insists that our redemption happens, at least in part, as we recollect those particles of grace and truth that we have come upon scattered around us in the ordinary tissue of our days. If we fail to remember, then the darkness of these days could be unbearable. If we fail to remember, we will give in to our angers and our fears and our despair. And there are plenty of politicians who will try to exploit them. But if in remembering, we can recall all the good that God has worked for life and redemption, how God does so in us and in others we know, then we may find our hearts and wills strengthened once again to work for God's purposes in the here and now. Because we remember, we can have hope, even in this world of terror and darkness. We can be joyful, as the poet says, even though we have considered all the facts. Because we have sacred memory, we can have hope, which is so important in this land that operates all too often by fear. We do have hope, and we need to give strong voice to those hopes in our day. That hope looks backwards so that we may remember and live forwards. And what is it that we remember? We remember that the tomb is empty, that Jesus is not confined by the grave, that we have reason to imagine finding life again, that life does not end in death, that sorrow and grief are never the final words, that we need not live fearfully, therefore, but boldly and faithfully, because what God has done, God will continue to do. And in the end, God will still be God. In the end, friends, the news is good. It is good because it is God's news. And it's good because in the end, its end is life and wholeness and justice and peace, not just for some, but for everyone. No limits. It is news we have heard many times before. It's the news we've rehearsed in the church Easter after Easter. But it bears rehearsing, for who knows when we will be called to remember. Do you remember the words? They began as a murmur among women at the tomb. The words were shared first timidly and then with increasing confidence, and finally with a shout. And even though they began in the deep dawn on that first Easter, today they echo and reverberate wherever Christ's followers gather. They echo within us. They shatter us and shake us and send us to our knees, even here, all these years later. Do you remember the words? Someone shouts, "Christ is risen," and we respond, "He is risen indeed." Can you try that with me? Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.
One more time. Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.
Indeed. Indeed. And I tell you, friends, that is good news. Very good news. And so important for us to remember, especially in these dark and demanding days.